This is Audible.
The Confessions of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Book 1, 1712 to 1719. I am commencing an undertaking, hitherto without precedent, and which will never find an imitator. I desire to set before my fellows the likeness of a man in all the truth of nature, and that man myself. Myself alone. I know the feelings of my heart, and I know men. I am not made like any of those I have seen. I venture to believe that I am not made like any of those who are in existence. If I am not better, at least I am different. Whether nature has acted rightly or wrongly in destroying the mould in which she cast me can only be decided after I have been read. Let the trumpet of the day of judgment sound when it will, I will present myself before the sovereign judge with this book in my hand. I will say boldly, this is what I have done, what I have thought, what I was. I have told the good and the bad with equal frankness. I have neither omitted anything bad nor interpolated anything good. If I have occasionally made use of some immaterial embellishments, this has only been in order to fill a gap caused by lack of memory. I may have assumed the truth of that which I knew might have been true, never of that which I knew to be false. I have shown myself as I was, mean and contemptible, good, high-minded and sublime, according as I was one or the other. I have unveiled my inmost self even as thou hast seen it, O eternal being. Gather round me the countless host of my fellow men. Let them hear my confessions, lament for my unworthiness, and blush for my imperfections. Then let each of them in turn reveal, with the same frankness, the secrets of his heart at the foot of the throne, and say, if he dare, I was better than that man. I was born at Geneva in the year 1712, and was the son of Isaac Rousseau and Suzanne Bernard, citizens. The distribution of a very moderate inheritance amongst 15 children had reduced my father's portion almost to nothing, and his only means of livelihood was his trade of watchmaker, in which he was really very clever. My mother, a daughter of the Protestant minister, Bernard, was better off. She was clever and beautiful, and my father had found difficulty in obtaining her hand. Their affection for each other had commenced almost as soon as they were born. When only 8 years old, they walked every evening upon the Treille. This is a fashionable promenade in Geneva. At 10, they were inseparable. Sympathy and union of soul strengthened in them the feeling produced by intimacy. Both, naturally full of tender sensibility, only waited for the moment when they should find the same disposition in another, or rather, this moment waited for them, and each abandoned his heart to the first which opened to receive it. Destiny, which appeared to oppose their passion, only encouraged it. The young lover, unable to obtain possession of his mistress, was consumed by grief. She advised him to travel and endeavour to forget her. He travelled, but without result, and returned more in love than ever. He found her, whom he loved, still faithful and true. After this trial of affection, nothing was left for them but to love each other all their lives. This they swore to do, and heaven blessed their oath. Gabriel Bernard, my mother's brother, fell in love with one of my father's sisters, who only consented to accept the hand of the brother on condition that her own brother married the sister. Love arranged everything, and the two marriages took place on the same day. Thus my uncle became the husband of my aunt, and their children were doubly my first cousins. At the end of a year a child was born to both, after which they were again obliged to separate. My uncle Bernard was an engineer. He took service in the Empire and in Hungary under Prince Eugene. He distinguished himself at the siege and battle of Belgrade. My father, after the birth of my only brother, set out for Constantinople, whither he was summoned to undertake the post of watchmaker to the Sultan. During his absence, my mother's beauty, intellect, and talents gained for her the devotion of numerous admirers. Her talents were too brilliant for her position, since her father, the minister who worshipped her, had educated her with great care. She drew, sang, accompanied herself on the theorb, a stringed instrument resembling a lute. She read much and wrote tolerable verses. During the absence of her husband and her brother, while walking with her sister-in-law and their two children, she delivered the following impromptu, when someone happened to mention them. Ces deux messieurs qui sont absents nous sont chers de bien des manières. Ce sont nos amis, nos amants, ce sont nos maris et nos frères, et les pères de ces enfants. Monsieur de la Closure, the French resident, was one of the most eager to offer his. His passion must have been great, for 30 years later I saw him greatly affected when speaking to me of her. To enable her to resist such advances, my mother had more than her virtue. She loved her husband tenderly. She pressed him to return. He left all and returned. I was the unhappy fruit of this return. 10 months later, I was born, a weak and ailing child. I cost my mother her life, and my birth was the first of my misfortunes. I have never heard how my father bore this loss, but I know that he was inconsolable. He believed that he saw his wife again in me, without being able to forget that it was I who had robbed him of her. He never embraced me without my perceiving, by his sighs and the convulsive manner in which he clasped me to his breast, that a bitter regret was mingled with his caresses, which were on that account only the more tender. When he said to me, "Jean-Jacques, let us talk of your mother," I used to answer, "Well then, my father, we will weep." And this word alone was sufficient to move him to tears. "Ah," said he with a sigh, "give her back to me, console me for her loss, fill the void which she has left in my soul. Should I love you as I do, if you were only my son?" 40 years after he had lost her, he died in the arms of a second wife, but the name of the first was on his lips and her image at the bottom of his heart. Such were the authors of my existence, of all the gifts which heaven had bestowed upon them. A sensitive heart is the only one they bequeathed to me. It had been the source of their happiness, but for me it proved the source of all the misfortunes of my life. I was brought into the world in an almost dying condition. Little hope was entertained of saving my life. I carried within me the germs of a complaint which the course of time has strengthened, and which at times allows me a respite only to make me suffer more cruelly in another manner. One of my father's sisters, an amiable and virtuous young woman, took such care of me that she saved my life. At this moment, while I'm writing, she is still alive, at the age of 80, nursing a husband younger than herself, but exhausted by excessive drinking. Dear aunt, I forgive you for having preserved my life, and I deeply regret that, at the end of your days, I am unable to repay the tender care which you lavished upon me at the beginning of my own. The name of this aunt was Madame Gonsérou. In March 1767, Rousseau settled upon her an income of 100 livres, and even in the time of his greatest distress, always paid it with scrupulous exactitude. My dear old nurse, Jacqueline, is also still alive, healthy and robust. The hands which opened my eyes at my birth will be able to close them for me at my death. I felt, before I thought, this is the common lot of humanity. I experienced it more than others. I do not know what I did until I was 5 or 6 years old. I do not know how I learned to read. I only remember my earliest reading and the effect it had upon me. From that time I date my uninterrupted self-consciousness. My mother had left some romances behind her, which my father and I began to read after supper, At first it was only a question of practicing me in reading by the aid of amusing books. But soon the interest became so lively that we used to read in turns without stopping, and spent whole nights in this occupation. We were unable to leave off until the volume was finished. Sometimes my father, hearing the swallows begin to twitter in the early morning, would say, quite ashamed, "Let us go to bed. I am more of a child than yourself." In a short time I acquired, by this dangerous method, not only extreme facility in reading and understanding what I read, but a knowledge of the passions that was unique in a child of my age. I had no idea of things in themselves, although all the feelings of actual life were already known to me. I had conceived nothing, but felt everything. These confused emotions, which I felt one after the other, certainly did not warp the reasoning powers which I did not as yet possess. But they shaped them in me of a peculiar stamp, and gave me odd and romantic notions of human life, of which experience and reflection have never been able wholly to cure me. 1719 to 1723. The romances came to an end in the summer of 1719. The following winter brought us something different. My mother's library being exhausted, we had recourse to the share of her father's, which had fallen to us. Luckily there were some good books in it. In fact, it could hardly have been otherwise, for the library had been collected by a minister, who was even a learned man according to the fashion of the day, and was at the same time a man of taste and intellect. The History of the Empire and the Church by Lesueur, Bossuet's Treatise upon Universal History, Plutarch's Lives of Famous Men, Nani's History of Venice, Ovid's Metamorphoses, La Bruyère, Fontenelle's Worlds, his Dialogues of the Dead, and some volumes of Molière. All these were brought over into my father's room, and I read to him out of them while he worked. I conceived a taste for them that was rare, and perhaps unique at my age. Plutarch especially became my favourite author. The pleasure I took in reading him over and over again cured me a little of my taste for romance, and I soon preferred Agesilaus, Brutus, and Aristides, to Orondates, Artemenes, and Juba. This interesting reading, and the conversations between my father and myself to which it gave rise, formed in me the free and republican spirit, the proud and indomitable character unable to endure slavery or servitude, which has tormented me throughout my life in situations the least fitted to afford its scope. Unceasingly occupied with thoughts of Rome and Athens, living as it were amongst their great men, myself by birth the citizen of a republic and the son of a father whose patriotism was his strongest passion, I was fired by his example. I believed myself a Greek or a Roman. I lost my identity in that of the individual whose life I was reading. The recitals of the quality of endurance and intrepidity which arrested my attention made my eyes glisten and strengthened my voice. One day, while I was relating the history of Scaevola at table, those present were alarmed to see me come forward and hold my hand over a chafing dish to illustrate his action. I had a brother 7 years older than myself who was learning my father's trade. The excessive affection which was lavished upon myself caused him to be somewhat neglected, which treatment I cannot approve of. His education felt the consequences of this neglect. He took to evil courses before he was old enough to be a regular profligate. He was put with another master, from whom he was continually running away, as he had done from home. I hardly ever saw him. I can scarcely say that I knew him. But I never ceased to love him tenderly, and he loved me as much as a vagabond can love anything. I remember that on one occasion, when my father was chastising him harshly and in anger, I threw myself impetuously between them and embraced him closely. In this manner I covered his body with mine, and received the blows which were aimed at him. I so obstinately maintained my position that at last my father was obliged to leave off, being either disarmed by my cries and tears, or afraid of hurting me more than him. At last my brother turned out so badly that he ran away and disappeared altogether. Some time afterwards we heard that he was in Germany. He never once wrote to us. From that time nothing more has been heard of him, and thus I have remained an only son. If this poor boy was carelessly brought up, this was not the case with his brother. The children of kings could not be more carefully looked after than I was during my early years. Worshipped by all around me, and, which is far less common, treated as a beloved, never as a spoiled child. Till I left my father's house, I was never once allowed to run about the streets by myself with the other children. In my case, no one ever had to satisfy or check any of those fantastic whims which are attributed to nature, but are all in reality the result of education. I had the faults of my age. I was a chatterbox, a glutton, and sometimes a liar. I would have stolen fruits, bonbons, or eatables. But I have never found pleasure in doing harm or damage, in accusing others, or in tormenting poor, dumb animals. I remember, however, that I once made water in a saucepan belonging to one of our neighbours, Madame Clot, while she was at church. I declare that even now the recollection of this makes me laugh, because Madame Clot, a good woman in other respects, was the most confirmed old grumbler I've ever known. Such is the brief and true story of all my childish offences. How could I become wicked when I had nothing but examples of gentleness before my eyes, and none around me but the best people in the world? My father, my aunt, my nurse, my relations, our friends, our neighbours, all who surrounded me did not, it is true, obey me, but they loved me, and I loved them in return. My wishes were so little excited and so little opposed that it did not occur to me to have any. I can swear that until I served under a master, I never knew what a fancy was, except during the time I spent in reading or writing in my father's company, or when my nurse took me for a walk. I was always with my aunt, sitting or standing by her side, watching her at her embroidery, or listening to her singing. And I was content. Her cheerfulness, her gentleness, and her pleasant face have stamped so deep and lively an impression on my mind that I can still see her manner, look, and attitude. I remember her affectionate language. I could describe what clothes she wore and how her head was dressed, not forgetting the two little curls of black hair on her temples, which she wore in accordance with the fashion of the time. I am convinced that it is to her I owe the taste, or rather passion, for music, which only became fully developed in me a long time afterwards. She knew a prodigious number of tunes and songs, which she used to sing in a very thin, gentle voice. This excellent woman's cheerfulness of soul banished dreaminess and melancholy from herself and all around her. The attraction which her singing possessed for me was so great that not only have several of her songs always remained in my memory, but even now, when I have lost her, and as I grew older, many of them, totally forgotten since the days of my childhood, return to my mind with inexpressible charm. Would anyone believe that I, an old dotard eaten up by cares and troubles, sometime find myself weeping like a child, when I mumble one of those little airs in a voice already broken and trembling? One of them especially has come back to me completely, as far as the tune is concerned. The second half of the words, however, has obstinately resisted all my efforts to recall it, although I have an indistinct recollection of the rhymes. Here is the beginning, and all that I can remember of the rest. Tircy, je n'ose écouter ton chalumeau sous l'eau, car on en cause déjà dans notre amour. Da 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 un berger, da 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 s'engager, da 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 son danger, et toujours l'épine est sous la rose. This song, well known in Paris, is still sung by the working classes. The sixth and following lines run, un cœur s'expose à trop s'engager, avec un berger, et toujours l'épine est sous la rose. Tircis, I dare not listen to your pipe under the elm. People are beginning to talk about it in the village. It is dangerous for a heart to have too much to do with a shepherd. There is no rose without its thorn. I ask, where is the affecting charm which my heart finds in this song? It is a whim, which I am quite unable to understand. But be that as it may, it is absolutely impossible for me to sing it through without being interrupted by my tears. I have intended, times without number, to write to Paris to make inquiries concerning the remainder of the words, in case anyone should happen to know them. But I am almost certain that the pleasure which I feel in recalling the air would partly disappear, if it should be proved that others, besides my poor Aunt Susan, have sung it. Such were my earliest emotions on my entry into life. Thus began to form, or display itself in me, that heart, at once so proud and tender, that character so effeminate but yet indomitable, which, ever wavering between timidity and courage, weakness and self-control, has throughout my life made me inconsistent, and has caused abstinence and enjoyment, pleasure and prudence equally to elude my grasp. This course of education was interrupted by an accident, the consequences of which have exercised an influence upon the remainder of my life. My father had a quarrel with a captain in the French army, named Gautier, who was connected with some of the members of the Common Council. This Gautier, a cowardly and insolent fellow, whose nose happened to bleed during the affray, in order to avenge himself, accused my father of having drawn his sword within the city walls. My father, whom they wanted to send to prison, persisted that, in accordance with the law, the accuser ought to be imprisoned as well as himself. Being unable to have his way in this, he preferred to quit Geneva and expatriate himself for the rest of his life, than to give way on a point in which honour and liberty appeared to him to be compromised. I remained under the care of my uncle Bernard, who was at the time employed upon the fortifications of Geneva. His eldest daughter was dead, but he had a son of the same age as myself. We were sent together to Bossy to board with the Protestant minister Lambercier, in order to learn, together with Latin, all the sorry trash which is included under the name of education. 2 years spent in the village in some degree softened my Roman roughness and made me a child again. At Geneva, where no tasks were imposed upon me, I loved reading and study, which were almost my only amusements. At Bossy, my tasks made me love the games which formed a break in them. The country was so new to me that my enjoyment of it never palled. I conceived so lively an affection for it that it has never since died out. The remembrance of the happy days I have spent there filled me with regretful longing for its pleasures at all periods of my life, until the day which has brought me back to it. Monsieur Lambercier was a very intelligent person, who, without neglecting our education, never imposed excessive tasks upon us. The fact that, in spite of my dislike of restraint, I have never recalled my hours of study with any feeling of disgust, and also that, even if I did not learn much from him, I learnt without difficulty what I did learn and never forgot it, is sufficient proof that his system of instruction was a good one. The simplicity of this country life was of inestimable value to me, in that it opened my heart to friendship. Up to that time I had only known lofty but imaginary sentiments. The habit of living peacefully together with my cousin Bernard drew us together in tender bonds of union. In a short time my feelings towards him became more affectionate than those with which I had regarded my brother, and they have never been effaced. He was a tall, lanky, weakly boy, as gentle in disposition as he was feeble in body, who never abused the preference which was shown to him in the house as the son of my guardian. Our tasks, our amusements, our tastes were the same. We were alone, we were of the same age, each of us needed a companion. Separation was to us, in a manner, annihilation. Although we had few opportunities of proving our mutual attachment, it was very great. Not only were we unable to live an instant apart, but we did not imagine it possible that we could ever be separated. Being both of us ready to yield to tenderness, and docile, provided compulsion was not used, we always agreed in everything. If, in the presence of those who looked after us, he had some advantage over me in consequence of the favour with which they regarded him, when we were alone I had an advantage over him, which restored the equilibrium. When we were saying our lessons, I prompted him if he hesitated. When I had finished my exercise, I helped him with his. And in our amusements, my more active mind always led the way. In short, our two characters harmonized so well, and the friendship which united us was so sincere, that in the 5 years and more, during which, whether at Bossy or Geneva, we were almost inseparable, although I confess that we often fought, it was never necessary to separate us. None of our quarrels ever lasted longer than a quarter of an hour, and neither of us ever made any accusation against the other. These observations are, if you will, childish, but they furnish an example which, since the time that there have been children, is perhaps unique. The life which I led at Bossy suited me so well that, had it only lasted longer, it would have completely decided my character. Tender, affectionate, and gentle feelings formed its foundation. I believe that no individual of our species was naturally more free from vanity than myself. I raised myself by fits and starts to lofty flights, but immediately fell down again into my natural languor. My liveliest desire was to be loved by all who came near me. I was of a gentle disposition. My cousin and our guardians were the same. During 2 whole years I was neither the witness nor the victim of any violent feeling. Everything nourished in my heart those tendencies which it received from nature. I knew no higher happiness than to see all the world satisfied with me and with everything. I shall never forget how, if I happened to hesitate when saying my catechism in church, nothing troubled me more than to observe signs of restlessness and dissatisfaction on Mademoiselle Lambercier's face. That alone troubled me more than the disgrace of failing in public, which nevertheless affected me greatly. For, although little susceptible to praise, I felt shame keenly, and I may say here that the thought of Mademoiselle's reproaches caused me less uneasiness than the fear of offending her. When it was necessary, however, neither she nor her brother were wanting in severity. But since this severity was nearly always just, and never passionate, it pained me without making me insubordinate. Failure to please grieved me more than punishment, and signs of dissatisfaction hurt me more than corporal chastisement. It is somewhat embarrassing to explain myself more clearly, but nevertheless I must do so. How differently would one deal with youth if one could more clearly see the remote effects of the usual method of treatment, which is employed always without discrimination, frequently without discretion? The important lesson which may be drawn from an example as common as it is fatal makes me decide to mention it. As Mademoiselle Lambercier had the affection of a mother for us, she also exercised the authority of one, and sometimes carried it so far as to inflict upon us the punishment of children when we had deserved it. For some time she was content with threats, and this threat of a punishment that was quite new to me appeared very terrible. But after it had been carried out, I found the reality less terrible than the expectation. And what was still more strange, this chastisement made me still more devoted to her who had inflicted it. It needed all the strength of this devotion and all my natural docility to keep myself from doing something which would have deservedly brought upon me a repetition of it. For I had found in the pain, even in the disgrace, a mixture of sensuality which had left me less afraid than desirous of experiencing it again from the same hand. No doubt some precocious sexual instinct was mingled with this feeling. For the same chastisement inflicted by her brother would not have seemed to me at all pleasant. But considering his disposition, there was little cause to fear the substitution, and if I kept myself from deserving punishment, it was solely for fear of displeasing Mademoiselle Lambercier. For so great is the power exercised over me by kindness, even by that which is due to the senses, that it has always controlled the latter in my heart. The repetition of the offence, which I avoided without being afraid of it, occurred without any fault of mine, that is to say, of my will, and I may say that I profited by it without any qualm of conscience. But this second time was also the last. For Mademoiselle Lambercier, who had no doubt noticed something which convinced her that the punishment did not have the desired effect, declared that it tired her too much, and that she would abandon it. Until then we had slept in her room, sometimes even in her bed during the winter. 2 days afterwards we were put to sleep in another room, and from that time I had the honour, which I would gladly have dispensed with, of being treated by her as a big boy. Who would believe that this childish punishment, inflicted upon me when only 8 years old by a young woman of 30, disposed of my tastes, my desires, my passions, and my own self for the remainder of my life, and that in a manner exactly contrary to that which should have been the natural result. When my feelings were once inflamed, my desires so went astray that, limited to what I had already felt, they did not trouble themselves to look for anything else. In spite of my hot blood, which has been inflamed with sensuality almost from my birth, I kept myself free from every taint until the age when the coldest and most sluggish temperaments begin to develop. In torments for a long time, without knowing why, I devoured with burning glances all the pretty women I met. My imagination unceasingly recalled them to me, only to make use of them in my own fashion, and to make of them so many Mesdemoiselles Lambercier. Even after I had reached years of maturity, this curious taste, always abiding with me and carried to depravity and even frenzy, preserved my morality, which it might naturally have been expected to destroy. If ever a bringing up was chaste and modest, assuredly mine was. My three aunts were not only models of propriety, but reserved to a degree which has long since been unknown amongst women. My father, a man of pleasure, but a gallant of the old school, never said a word, even in the presence of women whom he loved more than others, which would have brought a blush to a maiden's cheek. And the respect due to children has never been so much insisted upon as in my family and in my presence. In this respect I found Monsieur Lambercier equally careful, and an excellent servant was dismissed for having used a somewhat too free expression in our presence. Until I was a young man, I not only had no distinct idea of the union of the sexes, but the confused notion which I had regarding it never presented itself to me except in a hateful and disgusting form. For common prostitutes I felt a loathing which has never been effaced. The sight of a profligate always filled me with contempt, even with affright. My horror of debauchery became thus pronounced ever since the day when, walking to Little Saconex by a hollow way, I saw on both sides holes in the ground, where I was told that these creatures carried on their intercourse. The thought of the one always brought back to my mind the copulation of dogs, and the bare recollection was sufficient to disgust me. This tendency of my bringing up, in itself adapted to delay the first outbreaks of an inflammable temperament, was assisted, as I have already said, by the direction which the first indications of sensuality took in my case. Only busying my imagination with what I had actually felt, in spite of most uncomfortable effervescence of blood, I only knew how to turn my desires in the direction of that kind of pleasure with which I was acquainted, without ever going as far as that which has been made hateful to me, and which, without my having the least suspicion of it, was so closely related to the other. In my foolish fancies, in my erotic frenzies, in the extravagant acts to which they sometimes led me, I had recourse in my imagination to the assistance of the other sex, without ever thinking that it was serviceable for any purpose than that for which I was burning to make use of it. In this manner, then, in spite of an ardent, lascivious, and precocious temperament, I passed the age of puberty without desiring, even without knowing, of any other sensual pleasures than those of which Mademoiselle Lambercier had most innocently given me the idea. And when, in course of time, I became a man, that which should have destroyed me again preserved me. My old childish taste, instead of disappearing, became so associated with the other that I could never banish it from the desires kindled by my senses. And this madness, joined to my natural shyness, has always made me very unenterprising with women, for want of courage to say all or power to do all. The kind of enjoyment, of which the other was only for me the final consummation, could neither be appropriated by him who longed for it, nor guessed by her who was able to bestow it. Thus I have spent my life in idle longing, without saying a word, in the presence of those whom I loved most. Too bashful to declare my taste, I at least satisfied it in situations which had reference to it, and kept up the idea of it. To lie at the feet of an imperious mistress, to obey her commands, to ask her forgiveness, this was for me a sweet enjoyment, and the more my lively imagination heated my blood, the more I presented the appearance of a bashful lover. It may be easily imagined that this manner of making love does not lead to very speedy results, and is not very dangerous to the virtue of those who are its object. For this reason I have rarely possessed, but have nonetheless enjoyed myself in my own way, that is to say, in imagination. Thus it has happened that my senses, in harmony with my timid disposition and my romantic spirit, have kept my sentiments pure and my morals blameless, owing to the very tastes which, combined with a little more impudence, might have plunged me into the most brutal sensuality. I have taken the first and most difficult step in the dark and dirty labyrinth of my confessions. It is easier to admit that which is criminal than that which is ridiculous and makes a man feel ashamed. Henceforth, I am sure of myself. After having ventured to say so much, I can shrink from nothing. One may judge what such confessions have cost me from the fact that, during the whole course of my life, I have never dared to declare my folly to those whom I loved with the frenzy of a passion which deprived me of sight and hearing, which robbed me of my senses and caused me to tremble all over with a convulsive movement. I have never brought myself, even when on most intimate terms, to ask women to grant me the only favour of all which was wanting. This never happened to me but once, in my childhood, with a girl of my own age. Even then it was she who first proposed it. While thus going back to the first traces of my inner life, I find elements which sometimes appear incompatible, and yet have united in order to produce with vigour a simple and uniform effect. And I find others, which, although apparently the same, have formed combinations so different, owing to the cooperation of certain circumstances, that one would never imagine that these elements were in any way connected. Who, for instance, would believe that one of the most powerful movements of my soul was tempered in the same spring from which a stream of sensuality and effeminacy has entered my blood? Without leaving the subject of which I have just spoken, I shall produce by means of it a very different impression. One day I was learning my lesson by myself in the room next to the kitchen. The servant had put Mademoiselle Lambercier's combs in front of the fireplace to dry. When she came back to fetch them, she found one with a whole row of teeth broken. Who was to blame for the damage? No one except myself had entered the room. On being questioned, I denied that I had touched the comb. Monsieur and Mademoiselle Lambercier both began to admonish, to press, and to threaten me. I obstinately persisted in my denial, but the evidence was too strong and outweighed all my protestations, although it was the first time that I had been found to lie so boldly. The matter was regarded as serious, as in fact it deserved to be. The mischievousness, the falsehood, the obstinacy appeared equally deserving of punishment. But this time it was not by Mademoiselle Lambercier that chastisement was inflicted. My uncle Bernard was written to, and he came. My poor cousin was accused of another equally grave offence. We were involved in the same punishment. It was terrible. Had they wished to look for the remedy in the evil itself, and to deaden forever my depraved senses, they could not have set to work better, and for a long time my senses left me undisturbed. They could not draw from me the desired confession, although I was several times brought up before them and reduced to a pitiable condition. I remained unshaken. I would have endured death, and made up my mind to do so. Force was obliged to yield to the diabolical obstinacy of a child, as they called my firmness. At last I emerged from this cruel trial, utterly broken, but triumphant. It is now nearly 50 years since this incident took place, and I have no fear of being punished again for the same thing. Well, then, I declare in the sight of heaven that I was innocent of the offence, that I neither broke nor touched the comb, that I never went near the fireplace, and had never even thought of doing so. It would be useless to ask me how the damage was done. I do not know, and I cannot understand. All that I know for certain is that I had nothing to do with it. Imagine a child, shy and obedient in ordinary life, but fiery, proud, and unruly in his passions. A child who had always been led by the voice of reason, and always treated with gentleness, justice, and consideration, who had not even a notion of injustice, and who for the first time becomes acquainted with so terrible an example of it, on the part of the very people whom he most loves and respects. What an upset of ideas! What a disturbance of feelings! What revolution in his heart, in his brain, in the whole of his little intellectual and moral being! Imagine all this, I say, if possible. As for myself, I feel incapable of disentangling and following up the least trace of what then took place within me. I had not yet sense enough to feel how much appearances were against me, and to put myself in the place of the others. I kept to my own place, and all that I felt was the harshness of a frightful punishment for an offence which I had not committed. The bodily pain, although severe, I felt but little. All I felt was indignation, rage, despair. My cousin, whose case was almost the same, and who had been punished for an involuntary mistake as if it had been a premeditated act, following my example, flew into a rage, and worked himself up to the same pitch of excitement as myself. Both in the same bed, we embraced each other with convulsive transports. We felt suffocated. And when at length our young hearts, somewhat relieved, were able to vent their wrath, we sat upright in bed and began to shout, times without number, with all our might, "Carnifex! Carnifex! Carnifex!" Executioner, torturer. While I write these words, I feel that my pulse beats faster. Those moments will always be present to me, though I should live 100,000 years. That first feeling of violence and injustice has remained so deeply graven on my soul that all the ideas connected with it bring back to me my first emotion, and this feeling, which in its origin had reference only to myself, has become so strong in itself and so completely detached from all personal interest, that when I see or hear of any act of injustice, whoever is the victim of it, and wherever it is committed, my heart kindles with rage, as if the effect of it recoiled upon myself. When I read of the cruelties of a ferocious tyrant, the crafty atrocities of a rascally priest, I would gladly set out to plunge a dagger into the heart of such wretches, although I had to die for it 100 times. I have often put myself in a perspiration, pursuing or stoning a cock, a cow, a dog, or any animal which I saw tormenting another merely because it felt itself the stronger. This impulse may be natural to me, and I believe that it is, but the profound impression left upon me by the first injustice I suffered was too long and too strongly connected with it not to have greatly strengthened it. With the above incident, the tranquillity of my childish life was over. From that moment I ceased to enjoy a pure happiness, and even at the present day I feel that the recollection of the charms of my childhood ceases there. We remained a few months longer at Bossy. We were there, as the first man is represented to us, still in the earthly paradise. But we no longer enjoyed it. In appearance, our condition was the same. In reality, it was quite a different manner of existence. Attachment, respect, intimacy, and confidence no longer united pupils and guides. We no longer regarded them as gods who were able to read in our hearts. We became less ashamed of doing wrong and more afraid of being accused. We began to dissemble, to be insubordinate, to lie. All the vices of our age corrupted our innocence and threw a veil of ugliness over our amusements. Even the country lost in our eyes that charm of gentleness and simplicity which goes to the heart. It appeared to us lonely and sombre. It seemed as it were covered with a veil which concealed its beauties from our eyes. We ceased to cultivate our little gardens, our plants, our flowers. We no longer scratched up the ground gently or cried with joy when we saw the seed which we had sown beginning to sprout. We were disgusted with the life, and others were disgusted with us. My uncle took us away, and we separated from Monsieur and Mademoiselle Lambercier, having had enough of each other, and feeling but little regret at the separation. Nearly 30 years have passed since I left Boissy, without my recalling to mind my stay there with any connected and pleasurable recollections. But now that I have passed the prime of life and am approaching old age, I feel these same recollections springing up again while others disappear. They stamp themselves upon my memory with features, the charm and strength of which increase daily, as if, feeling life already slipping away, I were endeavouring to grasp it again by its commencement. The most trifling incidents of that time please me, simply because they belong to that period. I remember all the details of place, persons, and time. I see the maid or the man-servant busy in the room, a swallow darting through the window, a fly settling on my hand while I was saying my lesson. I see the whole arrangement of the room in which we used to live, Monsieur Lambercier's study on the right, a copperplate engraving of all the popes, a barometer, a large almanac hanging on the wall, the raspberry bushes which, growing in a garden situated on very high ground facing the back of the house, shaded the window and sometimes forced their way through it. I'm quite aware that the reader does not want to know all this, but I'm bound to tell him. Why have I not the courage to relate to him in like manner all the trifling anecdotes of that happy time, which still make me tremble with joy when I recall them? 5 or 6 in particular. But let us make a bargain. I will let you off 5, but I wish to tell you 1, only 1, provided that you will permit me to tell it in as much detail as possible in order to prolong my enjoyment. If I only had your pleasure in view, I might choose the story of Mademoiselle Lambercier's backside, which, owing to an unfortunate somersault at the bottom of the meadow, was exhibited in full view to the King of Sardinia, who happened to be passing by. But that of the walnut tree on the terrace is more amusing for me, who took an active part in it, whereas I was merely a spectator of the somersault. Besides, I declare that I found absolutely nothing to laugh at in an accident which, although comic in itself, alarmed me for the safety of a person whom I loved as a mother, and perhaps even more. Now, O curious readers of the important history of the walnut tree on the terrace, listen to the horrible tragedy, and keep from shuddering if you can. Outside the gate of the court, on the left of the entrance, there was a terrace, where we often went to sit in the afternoon. As it was entirely unprotected from the sun, Monsieur Lambercier had a walnut tree planted there. The process of planting was carried out with the greatest solemnity. The 2 boarders were its godfathers, and while the hole was being filled up, we each of us held the tree with one hand and sang songs of triumph. In order to water it, a kind of basin was made round the foot. Every day, eager spectators of this watering, my cousin and I became more strongly convinced, as was natural, that it was a finer thing to plant a tree on a terrace than a flag upon a breach. And we resolved to win this glory for ourselves without sharing it with anyone. With this object, we proceeded to cut a slip from a young willow, and planted it on the terrace at a distance of about 8 or 10 feet from the august walnut tree. We did not forget to dig a similar trench round our tree. The difficulty was how to fill it, for the water came from some distance, and we were not allowed to run and fetch it. However, it was absolutely necessary to have some for our willow. For a few days we had recourse to all kinds of devices to get some, and we succeeded so well that we saw it bud and put forth little leaves, the growth of which we measured every hour, convinced that, although not yet a foot high, it would soon afford us a shade. As our tree so completely claimed our attention that we were quite incapable of attending to or learning anything else, and were in a sort of delirium, as our guardians, not knowing what was the matter with us, kept a tighter hand upon us, we saw the fatal moment approaching when we should be without water, and were inconsolable at the thought of seeing our tree perish from drought. At length, necessity, the mother of invention, suggested to us how to save ourselves from grief and the tree from certain death. This was to make a channel underground, which should secretly conduct part of the water intended for the walnut tree to our willow. This undertaking was at first unsuccessful, in spite of the eagerness with which it was carried out. We had made the incline so clumsily that the water did not run at all. The earth fell in and stopped up the channel. The entrance was filled with mud. Everything went wrong. But nothing disheartened us. Labor omnia vincit improbus. Persistent effort overcomes all difficulties. We dug our basin deeper in order to allow the water to run. We cut some bottoms of boxes into small narrow planks, some of which were laid flat, one after the other, and others set up on both sides of these at an angle, thus forming a triangular canal for our conduit. At the entrance we stuck small pieces of wood, some little distance apart, which, forming a kind of grating or latticework, kept back the mud and stones without stopping the passage of the water. We carefully covered our work with well-trodden earth, and when all was ready we awaited, in the greatest excitement of hope and fear, the time of watering. After centuries of waiting, the hour at length arrived. Monsieur Lambercier came as usual to assist at the operation, during which we both kept behind him, in order to conceal our tree, to which very luckily he turned his back. No sooner had the first pail of water been poured out than we saw some of it running into our basin. At this sight our prudence deserted us. We began to utter cries of joy, which made Monsieur Lambercier turn round. This was a pity, for he took great delight in seeing how good the soil of the walnut tree was, and how greedily it absorbed the water. Astonished at seeing it distribute itself into two basins, he cried out in his turn, looked, perceived the trick, ordered a pickaxe to be brought, and with one blow broke off two or three pieces from our planks. Then crying loudly, "An aqueduct! An aqueduct!" he dealt merciless blows in every direction, each of which went straight to our hearts. In a moment, planks, conduit, basin, willow, everything was destroyed and uprooted, without his having uttered a single word, during this terrible work of destruction, except the exclamation which he incessantly repeated, "An aqueduct!" he cried, while demolishing everything, "An aqueduct! An aqueduct!" It will naturally be imagined that the adventure turned out badly for the little architects. That would be a mistake. It was all over. Monsieur Lambercier never uttered a single word of reproach, or looked upon us with displeasure, and said nothing more about it. Shortly afterwards we even heard him laughing loudly with his sister, for his laughter could be heard a long way off, and what was still more astonishing, when the first fright was over, we ourselves were not much troubled about the matter. We planted another tree somewhere else, and often reminded ourselves of the disaster that overtook the first, by repeating with emphasis, "An aqueduct! An aqueduct!" Hitherto I had had intermittent attacks of pride when I was Aristides or Brutus. Then it was that I felt the first well-defined promptings of vanity. To have been able to construct an aqueduct with our own hands, to have put a cutting in competition with a large tree, appeared to me the height of glory. At 10 years of age I was a better judge on this point than Caesar at 30. The thought of this walnut tree and the little history connected with it has remained so vivid in my memory, or returned to it, that one of the plans which gave me the greatest pleasure on my journey to Geneva in 1754 was to go to Bossy and revisit the memorials of my boyish amusements, above all the dear walnut tree, which by that time must have been a third of a century old. But I was so continually occupied, so little my own master, that I could never find the moment to afford myself this satisfaction. There is little prospect of the opportunity ever occurring again, yet the wish has not disappeared with the hope. And I am almost certain that if ever I should return to those beloved spots and find my dear walnut tree still alive, I should water it with my tears. After my return to Geneva, I lived for 2 or 3 years with my uncle, waiting until my friends had decided what was to be done with me. As he intended his own son to be an engineer, he made him learn a little drawing and taught him the elements of Euclid. I learned these subjects together with him, and acquired a taste for them, especially for drawing. In the meantime, it was debated whether I should be a watchmaker, an attorney, or a minister. My own preference was for the last, for preaching seemed to me to be a very fine thing. But the small income from my mother's property, which had to be divided between my brother and myself, was not sufficient to allow me to prosecute my studies. As, considering my age at that time, there was no immediate need to decide, I remained for the present with my uncle, making little use of my time, and in addition, as was only fair, paying a tolerably large sum for my board. My uncle, a man of pleasure like my father, was unable, like him, to tie himself down to his duties, and troubled himself little enough about us. My aunt was somewhat of a pietist, and preferred to sing psalms rather than attend to our education. We were allowed almost absolute freedom, which we never abused. Always inseparable, we were quite contented with our own society, and having no temptation to make companions of the street boys of our own age, we learned none of the dissolute habits into which idleness might have led us. I am even wrong in saying that we were idle, for we were never less so in our lives. And the most fortunate thing was that all the ways of amusing ourselves, with which we successively became infatuated, kept us together busy in the house, without our being even tempted to go out into the street. We made cages, flutes, shuttlecocks, drums, houses, squirts, and crossbows. Squirts are équifles. According to a note in the Firmin Didot edition, this word is the Genovese equivalent of canonniere, a popgun, but Littré explains it as a squirt. We spoilt my good old grandfather's tools in trying to make watches as he did. We had a special taste for wasting paper, drawing, painting in watercolours, illuminating and spoiling colours. An Italian showman named Gambacorta came to Geneva. We went to see him once and never wanted to go again. But he had a marionette show, and we proceeded to make marionettes. His marionettes played comedies, and we composed comedies for ours. For want of a squeaker, we imitated Punch's voice in our throat, in order to play the charming comedies, which our poor and kind relations had the patience to sit and listen to. But my uncle Bernard, having one day read aloud in the family circle a very fine sermon, which he'd composed himself, we abandoned comedy and began to write sermons. These details are not very interesting, I confess, but they show how exceedingly well conducted our early education must have been, seeing that we, almost masters of our time and ourselves, at so tender an age, were so little tempted to abuse our opportunities. We had so little need of making companions that we even neglected the chances of doing so. When we went for a walk, we looked at their amusements as we passed by without the slightest desire, or even the idea of taking part in them. Our friendship so completely filled our hearts that it was enough for us to be together to make the simplest amusements a delight. Being thus inseparable, we began to attract attention, the more so as, my cousin being very tall while I was very short, we made an oddly assorted couple, his long, slim figure, his little face like a boiled apple, his gentle manner and his slovenly walk excited the children's ridicule. In the patois of the district he was nicknamed Bana Bredana, and directly we went out we heard nothing but Bana Bredana all round us. He endured it more quietly than I did. I lost my temper and wanted to fight. This was just what the little rascals desired. I fought and was beaten. My poor cousin helped me as well as he could, but he was weak, and a single blow of the fist knocked him down. Then I became furious. However, although I received blows in abundance, I was not the real object of attack, but Bana Bredana. But my obstinate anger made matters so much worse that in future we only ventured to go out during school.